House Workforce and Economic Development Committee. We are now in order. And the first item this morning is a public hearing on House Bill 3418. I'm going to open a public hearing on that. Ellen, if you would please give us a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 3418 establishes the Oregon Main Street Program in the State Department of Parks and Recreation. It authorizes the department to assist local governments in establishing downtown revitalization programs by providing technical assistance and grant funding. It authorizes the department to make rules regarding program implementation.
Thank you very much, and it's our pleasure to call forward First Lady Mary Oberst. Good morning, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. I'm Mary Oberst, the First Lady of the State of Oregon, and I appreciate your letting me testify first to accommodate my kind of crazy Wednesday schedule. I wanted to give you just a brief little overview of the Main Street, proposed Main Street program, and why we're here with this program in this session. Oregon actually had a Main Street program back in the early 80s, but that program lapsed for several reasons, including loss of state funding. Some of the services of that program are provided by other state agencies now, and also the Oregon Downtown Development Association. I think many of you know that I was quite involved in fundraising for restoring the Cam Wah Chung and Company Museum in John Day, and that project led me in many different pathways. I learned, for example, that state surveys have shown that Oregonians want enhanced protection of our historic property and our collections and our historic places. I learned that Oregonians have a very strong sense of place. I learned that heritage tourism is very important in our economic picture statewide. And I learned about the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which is a Washington, D.C.-based group that I think I had admired from afar but never really understood quite what they did. Well, one thing that the National Trust does is they run a thing called National Main Streets, and that is sort of a template that you can import into your state. It has to do with downtown and neighborhood commercial district revitalization. It's community-driven. It's comprehensive. It helps revitalize older traditional business districts. And as I travel around the state, often with my husband and sometimes by myself, it occurred to me that a Main Streets program like the National Trust has could do wonders for many of our small, especially rural towns, especially west of the Cascades, towns like John Day, which I got really familiar with in my Cam Wah Chung project. So I started talking to a lot of people, people from the National Trust, people around Oregon, people who work with historic preservationists and tourism and economic development. And we created a little committee of about 10 or 15 people to think about how to bring a Main Streets program to Oregon. And we worked with the National Trust. I learned that the National Trust Main Street program has been going on for about 25 years and is hugely successful in teaching communities how to revitalize their business districts, how to create more jobs, how to preserve their unique historic places. I learned that many of our state agency leaders are really interested in revitalizing our Main Street here in Oregon. I talked to leaders in our housing agency, economic development, LCDC, transportation. You'll hear from some of them today. You'll also hear from the Oregon Downtown Development Association. These are all partners in our proposed Main Street program. Essentially, the program is part of the governor's larger effort to strengthen history and culture in Oregon and to bring heritage tourism to Oregon's small towns. And the program from the National Trust essentially has 4 points, design, economic restructuring, promotion, and organization. And these are the 4 points that each individual community in Oregon would concentrate on with the help of the statewide Main Street coordinator. We have a bit of a funding request in the CHAMP program, in the governor's budget, the culture, history, arts, movies, and preservation, P for preservation program. The co-chairs cut that budget somewhat. I'm hoping to get it restored. But that's where the funding is for this Main Street program. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Otherwise, I'll turn the mic over to my cohorts who can tell you more about the program and the details of it.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee for the First Lady? Representative Bell?
No, a comment, I guess. We were very, very pleased with your interest in John Day and the work that
you
had done. And if I missed an opportunity to say thank you, I'd kick myself.
No need to do that, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Next, I'd like to call up Bob Repine and Roger Roper, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Roger Roper. I'm the Assistant Director for Heritage Programs at Parks and Recreation. And we're also the State Historic Preservation Office. We are the agency in state government that promotes the preservation of historic buildings and assists communities around the state with revitalization efforts regarding historic buildings. The Main Street program is a program we support wholeheartedly. It's one we've been hoping could come to Oregon. Many of our constituents have been needing that extra element of the economic revitalization that goes beyond just the preservation of historic buildings. And so we see it as an exciting new dimension that serves the rural constituents and other smaller communities around the state. And a partner in this, of course, is the Economic and Community Development Department. And I think Bob wants to say a few things.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. Bob Repine, Director of Economic and Community Development Committee members. I'm here to add my support to this bill. One of the things I've learned in my career in government, both in my housing career and now in my economic development career, is that we have communities that have real opportunities around the state of Oregon, and much of it relies on the viability and the vitality of their downtowns. As I was the housing director, we promoted downtown discussions on how to rethink of introducing housing to the downtown cores to put that lifeblood back on the street so stores could stay open, so businesses would stay in town as opposed to moving on to larger locations. So I learned early that downtowns were a critical piece of community's success. Now in the Economic Development Agency, once again, I've seen the opportunity in many of our communities where business recruitment is more difficult, let's say, than we might see in some larger metropolitan areas. And when you go visit their downtowns, that becomes really their key asset for economic development. They have a gem in many cases that need to be repolished a little bit or reset in a new setting, but they have tremendous opportunities to have a entree to their community that really talks about and speaks about the economic viability of their community. And so I see this as being a huge opportunity for coupling up with activities with the community to polish the downtown, bring it to a level that really cries out that we're ready and open for business, which then attracts better opportunities for me to do recruitment for businesses who, when they do as a front windshield drive through a town, if they go through a town and they see half the storefronts are closed or out of business, the likelihood of the company is going to say, well, let's keep on driving until we find a town or a community that's open for business. So anything we can do to keep our communities open and viable just gives me one more reason and a very appropriate reason for businesses to want to locate there. And so I think there's really tremendous opportunities with bringing this back into Oregon. As you heard from the First Lady and Roger, we had this program in the agency, actually, my agency, Economic Development, back in the 1990 era. It terminated, from what I understand, about 1997. For financial reasons, primarily budget reductions, but we're in a changing environment. I think this is an opportunity in today's world of economy for the state of Oregon that we reinvest in this and really step up to the plate once again. Couple with the national organization, work with our nonprofit organizations that have kind of carried the load in Oregon for the last few years through Oregon Downtown Development Association, and make this program really a viable program once again in Oregon.
Questions or comments? Representative Dolan?
Yes, Bob, do you have at your fingertips the governor's proposed budget and the co-chair's budget? Do you have those numbers?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Dolan, the amount that was proposed in the governor's budget for this program was $750,000. The co-chair's budget reports to be, recommends $500,000. The reason both Roger and I are sitting here, other than we served with the First Lady on this task force of individuals talking about this because of our interest in it, total interest in it, is that the governor's budget and the bill, as you see, suggests that the Parks Department would be the kind of the repository of this activity. The co-chair's budget or recommendations suggest that the program moves over to my agency. So there's still some question of where it's going to be, I guess. So we figure we'll tag team here a little bit relative to where it will eventually end up at the end of the day. I think either one of us, both Roger and I, have had discussions about this, and we both feel very comfortable it could end up in either one of our shops without any difficulties, and we're happy to receive it. But it does create a little process problem for you as a committee, because the current bill that you have suggests one thing versus what the co-chairs are recommending in their budget. And how we facilitate that, I talked to the chair prior, I don't know exactly. I suggested maybe we put a change of dashman and put my name in there, or my agency's name in there. I'm almost to the mind where I might suggest we might just want to put a blank line in there, let somebody fill it in whenever it's determined. That might be an appropriate way to do that, Mr. Chairman, because I think if it does go down into the Ways and Means process, from what I understand, has a subsequent referral with a line like we do with budgeting issues, sometimes you can just fill the line in, assuming that the committee would find it favorable that wherever it landed, either in Parks or in my agency, would be appropriate to at least to defend the statutory intent of what the bill would end up being.
Okay. Vice Chairman.
Yes, and thank you very much, Chair. I think some of my questions has been answered, but one of my simple questions, why it's called Oregon Main Street Program? It's confusing sometimes. It looks like a more downtown development program, but the name is Main Street Program. Where the name come from? Why is to be called that way?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Lim, I suspect probably Vicki Duggar, who will be testifying, who represents the Oregon Downtown Development Association. I think the history is because we are replicating or mirroring the National Main Street Program. So in order to meet the criteria that are set forth with the National Main Street Program, I think the references to Main Street is a reflection of the national program.
Okay. And just make a comment.
Please.
As I understand it, it looks like a more comfortable sitting, this program, in the economic development instead of the parks and the recreation department. I don't know why it's in the bill says and establish this program in the State Department of Parks and Recreation.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Lim, I'm sure Mr. Roper can speak for this also, but at least from my understanding, or the original thought process was, because of the four elements that were mentioned by the First Lady that represent the national model, design is one of those four elements. Design implies historical evaluation of structures in downtowns. That's under the preview of the Parks Department through their SHPO program. Historic Preservation Office. I didn't want to get caught with an acronym. So that was one of the reasons it was headed over there, because they have one of the corner pieces of it. Just as much in my agency, which is the on the economic restructuring piece, so I would be a participant on the economic resources possibility. So we each own a piece of one of the four components of the Main Street program. So I think it was just this was the choice that was made at the time.
Okay. Just make a comment, Mr. Chair. Please. I'm from the Gresham area, the Gresham downtown, including many other cities, need to revitalization. And I'm hoping with this program we can invest some, and then the downtown should be the center of the city. But right now, the most downtowns in Oregon are not prospering well, other than the Portland area. So I just want to thank the First Lady, Mary, proposing this bill, and I do really appreciate it.
Additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, would you be willing to take a walk down the hall and have some amendments drafted that might further specify who, if anyone, or leaves it open, has oversight over this?
Mr. Chairman, I think that'd be fine. Roger and I talked about it briefly before the meeting started. Again, after rethinking it, if legislative council agrees that allowing the line to be left open, where you can fill the blank, so to speak, until we kind of figure out with certainty which way it's going to land, because we could arguably change it from parks to economic development, and something might change between this point in time and the final budget presentation that might cause it to change back. So maybe leaving it as a blank isn't a bad thing at this point, if that's legislatively acceptable.
Okay. All right. If you'd check on that, I'd appreciate it. We can get that resolved soon. The timeline's getting short here for us to move bills out. So appreciate your riding herd on that.
Will do.
Thanks very much. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Christina McNitt and Julie Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I am representing today a group called the Cultural Advocacy Coalition in support of House Bill 3418. I think you just heard from the two departments that basically this is the policy bill that implements the Oregon Main Street program, which is included in both the governor's recommended budget and in the co-chair's budget. The question is, where is the program going to reside? The program is one piece of something that the First Lady already mentioned on the record, CHAMPS. It's a cultural reinvestment package for culture, history, arts, movies, and preservation. We're very excited to be moving this package through the legislature. And with that, I would support either a line amendment or maybe even just moving it as is to the Ways and Means Committee for amendments there. Either way, I hope this committee would support the bill if it do pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Osborne. I live here in Salem at 3251 Bluff Avenue Southeast, and I am a small business owner, so I'm representing the small business owners, myself, but as an example. I've had years of career experience in the public sector, working as a city planner and as a manager of state programs related to historic preservation, as well as working as a private consultant with Main Street communities throughout Oregon and other western states. And so I have a good understanding of the challenges facing both the business owners and the cities. As a small business owner, I can attest to the fact that we are passionate about what we do to enhance the quality of life in our cities. And we spend hours planning and implementing ways to keep our businesses going, but we're mostly dealing with day-to-day issues and wishing that we could get to the long-range plans more quickly. We have to offer something unique to overcome the new shopping center and centers and outlet malls that are springing up all over, as well as the internet marketplace. We need help with that outreach and ways to attract people to our shops so they can appreciate the personal service and the unique products we offer, which often include works from local artisans. And I can speak from firsthand experience that advertising in the local newspaper does little to get customers into the shop. It's creating new, unique experiences and word of mouth that make the difference. There's an uphill battle to revitalize historic downtown business districts. And most immediately, I can speak to Salem, which has implemented some good programs and funding mechanisms to encourage revitalization. However, the competing needs for developing the city as a whole take staff time and money away from the promotion of the downtown. There needs to be a consistent focus that is not distracted by those competing needs. To have a program in place with a manager who can promote the special qualities and sense of place that we bring to the main streets of our cities is absolutely invaluable. Main Street is the kind of tried and true program with 25 years success rate, and it's proven to be effective in many western states where I've worked. I can't emphasize enough the importance of having a way to bring the small business owners and a community and the city together to promote our main streets and their and what we have to offer. Each city in Oregon has a unique character, and this is where the core of it lies. The Main Street program creates a partnership between the city and business owners to increase stability, provide professional services such as building restoration, marketing and promotions, and economic analysis that are really critical to helping our downtowns look better and draw people to them. And heritage tourism is a really important goal. I wholeheartedly support the Main Street program and encourage the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee to support it as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very, very much. Questions for our panel? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call up, please, David Skilton and Vicki Duggar.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, the rest of the committee. My name is Vicki Duggar. For the record, I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Downtown Development Association. And we are a state and now region-wide nonprofit whose mission is to assist communities achieve revitalization success. Our organization is almost 25 years old. We're getting ready to have our big birthday. And for many years, were subcontractors through the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to deliver the original Main Street program. I moved to Oregon about 12 years ago as a Main Street manager from Oklahoma that had a terrific Main Street program, so came here very grounded in that approach. Understand the value of it. It was a very strong program here in the state until funding issues, and the program was taken away. So who would have thought years later, we've kind of gone through the tradition to say it's not just about family wage jobs, which are very important, but it's about having the kind of inviting, vital heart and soul of your community that can really help attract those kinds of jobs that Bob talked about. It's about really having that legacy in your community of historic properties that really shine and that you can point, you know, you want these for generations to come. And so it's all of the elements pulled together. This is a very comprehensive program. It's a great program. It's a program that works. And with great record keeping, states, communities can say for every dollar invested, state dollar invested into this program has terrific leverage, $28 up to $30 and more in some instances. So you can see there's a very good return on investment for this program. It builds capacity. It's autonomous within the communities, although they do need to sort of follow this approach. I think in Oregon, it's really going to be an important piece of the puzzle to have kind of the traditional and what I call more strict formulaic Main Street program in place, but also because communities are on a continuum of economic development. And so to also have some services that are going to benefit the communities that can't quite make it with a full-time manager at that point yet. So to help them build their capacity, the smaller communities. So it's a great program. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about our work with Main Street in the past and kind of what we're doing now and how we see all the pieces fit together.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do is hold off on questions until Mr. Skilton has an opportunity to testify as well.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is David Skilton. I live just down the street at 1880 Court Street here in Salem. And I've taken time off from work today. I'm representing myself, uh-huh. Not the city of Salem. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 3418, a proposal to establish the Oregon Main Street Program. And I think that by adopting the National Trust model, the bill takes us down a proven path, so I'm not going to go back over that again. A little background about myself so that you to give you some context for my testimony, I have master's degrees in architecture and historic preservation. I'm a former staff member of the State Historic Preservation Office. I worked there for 11 years in positions that took me into lots of small communities around the state. I've crawled through hundreds of underutilized buildings all around the state of Oregon. And I'm a former board member of Vicki's organization. I'm really glad to be here at the table with her. And I'm also a former planning commissioner from the cities of Coburg and Salem. I currently work for the City of Salem Urban Development Department, working on downtown projects here in Salem. While the Main Street program is going to benefit any community that opts to participate, the reason I took time off to come to work today is because I think it has the greatest potential to help the small communities of the state. Those remarkable little places where people have developed real plays, they won my heart a long time ago when I was traveling around the state, and I've actually been to 234 of Oregon's 242 incorporated cities. So there are lots of really wonderful places in Oregon that are going to benefit by this program. Much of my testimony here is going over ground that you have already heard about, so I'm not going to go over all that. But I did want to say, in response to Representative Lim's questions about how it could benefit larger communities, that I agree that there are communities like Gresham, Beaverton, and Band, for example, where there is a lot of stress being placed on the original downtown area by development, the growth, the rapid growth. And I think this program can actually help those downtowns as well. I think it's appropriate to establish a program at the state level because it helps the whole state. The resources that are in these small communities and large communities are valuable to everyone, not just to the people who live there. And the responsibility for taking care of them resides locally, but they're valuable to everyone. So I would just point out some examples of projects that have, the character of what we're talking about. I would encourage you to look at the Grand Hotel project in Roseburg, the E.M.&M project in Enterprise, the Condon Hotel in Condon, or the Liberty Theater in Astoria as examples of the kind of project that this program would help bring about. And my testimony, you'll see in the written version, I endorse the idea of this going to the Parks and Recreation Department, not just because I'm a former parkie, but because I think that the SHPO has the expertise that is needed to run the program. But that said, I think that the Economic Development Department would make an equally good home for it. I have the greatest respect for, especially for their field staff, who I would meet on a regular basis when I was traveling around the state in your constituencies. The one thing that I would request that be added to the bill is a reporting requirement, because I know from having done this myself that when you're in the day-to-day struggle to get your work done, you don't pay attention always to gathering the information that's going to make it valuable to policymakers, for example, like yourselves. So I would just add a simple requirement to report every 2 years starting in 2009. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any quick questions or comments? Not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. And Mr. Skilton, I think the importance is underscored by the fact that you've taken time off from work today to come testify. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And next, I'd like to call up Representative Butler. I saw him a second ago. There he is. Good Good morning, Representative. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume you're on House Bill 2418.
Yes, 3418.
3418, yes. Beg pardon. Not good with numbers. Oh, no. All these years. House Representative 60, Tom Butler, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to testify on behalf of 3418 that this is not a new initiative in Oregon. We've had the Oregon Main Street program under different names in the past. You've heard other testimony, I understand, this morning while I've been involved in other places of the building. But my anxiety is that that small local communities or sections of larger communities can have an opportunity and be incentivized to maintain their historic and commercial nature as well as preserving their heritage and their customs and cultures, and to be able to have, and I understand that there's some concern as to whether or not the Main Street program ought to vest in the State Parks and Recreation Department or whether it ought to be over in the OECDD. The bill before you today does in fact ask for the program to vest in the State Parks and Recreation. I feel very strongly that SHPO, State Historic Preservation Office, has excellent leadership and folks that can help us give the proper direction to get the Main Street program implemented and keep it going. Of course, the funding is a separate issue, and if we can get the Main Street program, by passing 3418, if we can get the Main Street program up and running in the state of Oregon, I feel particularly as we move closer to 2009 and our sesquicentennial that we will have an opportunity to have more community awareness and outreach in our communities to move back to our original roots and some of our heritage and some of these remote locations as well as some of the districts in some of the larger metropolitan areas of the state of Oregon. So I subscribe to you that this is a excellent thing for us to be doing and would encourage and request your support for it.
Thank you very much, Representative Butler. Questions or comments for our colleague? I'm
Thank
not
you.
Seeing any. Thank you so
Thank
very
you,
much.
Well, my pleasure.
And is there anyone else left who would like to testify today on House Bill 3418?
Just a comment, if I may.
Yes, please.
If you're inclined to move this, and I hope you are, I think it's a very good bill, I would recommend from this chair that we leave this in the Parks Department for now, and since it's going to Ways and Means, if they want to move it to a different spot, they can do that. I'd like to see it move quickly, and I'd also like to put on the record that I hope that Ways and Means restores the governor's budget funds.
Thank you very, very much, Vice Chair Riley, and the chair is open to any department accommodating oversight for that, whatever will best make this program work. I think it's a very important program, and as we've heard several times this morning already, would be a very big boost to economic development in a lot of our communities. With that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3418. For any of the representatives who will be testifying on House Bill 3252, Representatives Rosenbaum, Galizio, and Kotek, you're on deck if you're listening to the television. In fact, if I could ask for a volunteer from the audience to maybe check some of the other hearing rooms to see if either Representatives Rosenbaum, Galizio, or Kotek are in another hearing room. Okay, very good. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And there he is.
Okay.
And there he is. Talk about a timely entrance. Okay, I'll now open a hearing on House Bill 3252. And Ellen, if you could please give us a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 3252 requires the Department of Human Services to annually publish a list of employers with employees who receive public medical assistance, public insurance assistance, temporary assistance for needy families, food stamps, or any other public assistance. The list shall include the number of employees receiving the assistance but may not have individual identifiers. It authorizes the Department of Human Services to collect employer information on employee on applications for assistance.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call forward, please, Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Larry Galizio, House District 35. And good morning to everybody.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee.
It's a pleasure. So I would just like to explain why I'm chief co-sponsor of this bill, and I'm pretty certain that Representative Rosenbaum will be joining us shortly, and she'll also get into some of the specifics. But in the grand scheme of things, the idea of the bill, as far as I'm concerned, and why I am supportive, are the ideas of, number one, having an informed citizenry. Secondly, the idea of transparency. And third, the idea of accountability. So the other day I bought a candy bar, and I guess I shouldn't talk about that because of the vending bill and all that. But anyway, and the ingredients were listed in quite a lot of detail. So as a consumer of that candy bar, I could make a decision about the cost-benefit analysis and my health. I hope that's not my phone. And I think that's useful. I made the unfortunate decision to actually eat that candy bar, but that's my own decision. So I think in the same way, citizens and consumers have to make, you know, are making choices all the time about everything from where they shop, what kind of companies and businesses they do or do not want in their community. And in order to make an intelligent, informed decision, you need information. So there are, you know, public companies have quite a bit of information, but there's often a lot of information that's hidden from the public. So the idea, as far as I'm concerned with this bill, is to provide more transparency, access to information that I think is valuable for consumers and citizens, and accountability. So we hear there are a lot of companies that seek tax breaks from states and other municipalities, and the idea is that it's kind of a cost-benefit analysis, and if a state wants to lure a company, they can provide tax breaks. And the citizens have to make decisions about this, usually indirectly, but I think the idea is that you need full disclosure, and again, transparency. So if you have a company, for example, in the case of where I reside in Tigard, and there's been talk for quite some time about a Walmart sighting in Tigard, and a lot of people like to shop there. The prices tend to be lower. However, there, when you look at the cost of a pair of socks, you also have to think about other costs. So what this bill seeks to do is to provide information for consumers and citizens so that they know that the employees of, for example, Walmart often sign up for social services that then are, these are taxpayer-subsidized services. So you might be getting inexpensive pair of socks, but at the same time, your taxes and the services that you're covering as a citizen in the state, you might be paying and subsidizing that company's costs because their employees don't have health care, so you're subsidizing it, more people on the Oregon Health Plan, and other kinds of social services. So the idea in this bill is that it provides consumers and citizens with information about the social services and the subsidies, quite frankly, that consumers and citizens are paying when certain companies are in the state or in the community. And so I'll let my colleague go into some specific detail, but that's the idea of the bill, accountability, transparency, and informed citizenry.
Thank you very much, Representative Glizio. Good morning, Representative Rosenbaum.
Good morning, Welcome. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I am Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative from Hess District 42 in Southeast and Northeast Portland and Speaker Pro Tem of the Oregon House. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about House Bill 3252, which I think is a very simple bill, which, as my colleague said, is really about transparency and accountability, things that we talk a lot about here. But this is a bill that actually, I think, can give us some tools to really be accountable with taxpayer dollars. It's a simple piece of legislation that just requires the state to publish an annual report detailing how many workers depend on public services such as food stamps, TANF, the Oregon Health Plan, and to break those numbers down by employer. We know that, according to Business Week, 28 million Americans meet the definition of working poor. In other words, they're people who are working full-time, but they're still below the poverty line. Many other states have used a bill such as this to try to get some control on how their state programs may be subsidizing some large employers. Ohio and Georgia in particular have adopted legislation like this and found it very useful in finding out exactly what was going on in terms of these subsidies. The bill will not sacrifice anyone's confidentiality or privacy, but it will allow our state to at least begin to measure the extent to which our tax dollars are subsidizing similar behavior in Oregon. And we were actually able to get some pretty startling statistics to look at what we're talking about and what kind of information we might elicit if we had this tool available. In 2005, the Democratic staff of the in Congress, the U.S. House Committee on Education and Workforce, estimated a breakdown for just one 200-employee big box store. And these are the numbers that they came up with, and you'll find these in my written testimony, too. And this is for just a 200-employee employer. $36,000 a year for free or reduced school lunches. $42,000 a year for rental assistance under Section 8 housing, $125,000 a year for federal tax credits and deductions, $108,000 a year for additional federal contribution to the state children's health insurance program, otherwise known as the CHIP program, $100,000 a year for additional Title I expenses, and $9,750 a year for additional costs for low-income energy assistance. So overall, they estimated that the single store with 200 employees paying substandard wages would result in an excess cost of $420,750 a year for federal taxpayers. We think this is not a responsible use of tax dollars. It's one thing, and we certainly fully support programs that encourage business and economic development when there's job creation involved and when these businesses actually need a leg up and some help to get started or to, in some cases, be able to retain employees. But that's not what we're talking about with these kinds of subsidies. These are highly profitable businesses. Walmart is the example that's most commonly cited. And when they are able to pay wages that rely on our programs, our taxpayer-funded programs, it's something that we think we at least need to take a look at, and we need this tool to enable us to do that. So I think that it's a simple bill. It's one that I hope you can all support, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Rowley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may. First, does this bill single out any companies at all? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, indeed it does not. I mean, we certainly talk a lot about Walmart just because it's a very large employer and it's often an example of the kind of thing that we're talking about. The bill itself certainly does not target or single out any employer. So it's simply providing information.
And quick follow-up. In the report that's going to be produced if this bill becomes law, Will the companies be identified by name?
Yeah, the companies will be identified by name.
Go ahead.
And I think we need that.
As do I. I just wanted to be sure.
Yeah, and I would just, I think some people might try to characterize this kind of legislation as saying, sort of somehow anti-business. I think quite the opposite. In the marketplace, information is very critical. There's also a marketplace of ideas. So this is a pro-consumer, pro-citizen bill is what it is. It just says you as a citizen and you as a consumer have a right to know this kind of information about that. These are your tax dollars at work. So this is information that should not be hidden. It's not violating privacy. It just provides people, it empowers consumers is what it does.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I would also add that I think it is a pro-business bill in the sense that other businesses are trying to compete with these businesses, often without the benefit of these taxpayer subsidies. And so we want to level the playing field, and we think this is one way to do that.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. The question I would have is I have a huge contingency of agriculture in my district. There's no agricultural exemption in this bill. And if you go harvest Christmas trees for a month, you might have people that would obviously turn up on your list. And so you'd have a huge number of farmers that would end up on your list. And I would see that as a real fallacy. So are you interested in entertaining some idea of having an agricultural exemption?
I think we'd be happy to talk to you about potential amendments to the bill. I don't think that farms are really, there may be large corporate farms that might be an example of the kind of thing we're talking about, but I doubt that that's the primary thing that's going to be turned up anyway. So,
and also, we have to give people credit. In other words, the public that would take the time to read such a report, I think they would make distinctions. I think too often people, quite frankly, in this building, don't give people enough credit. And I think people would make distinctions among employers. But still, I agree. I think there's room for...
Representative Dolan.
I'm wondering why we wouldn't include government. And I think the notion is, and there's is to foster living wages, so that when the statement at my breakfast table when I was a young, very young boy was, a person is worthy of their hire, and that's where we're trying to go with this. But why would we not then talk about government agencies also? I'm looking at this from Representative Galizio's last statement. There's going to be a certain percentage that I just did the school lunch figures, and it's amazing how fast school lunch subsidies add up for an individual. And this wouldn't put your example here completely out of the line with the general population in the schools I've served. So what I want to know is why wouldn't we do this for every agency that employs? And then we would have a benchmark, if you would, where we could say you're above the norm, you're below the norm, you're way above. And as Representative Galizio says, give stars rather than sticks. So I would like it to be all-inclusive so that we could look at everybody that employs.
Well, I'm not Mr. Chair, Representative Dallum, I'm not sure I'm totally following you, because the way this bill would work is as people were applying for public assistance of some kind, there would simply, and actually I think this information is being collected already, we would find out what employer they worked for, and then we would be tallying the employer, and the report we would get would not name individual employees, but it would name companies. So,
I don't think I'm deviating. I think we're in the same place, but I would like to know where the state stacks up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalm, in other words, if state employees were applying for and qualifying for some form of public assistance, you would want to see that information.
And my interest is really piqued because we had a very heated testimony right in this room about employing disabled people, but I think you have to dig that out a little bit. So I would like to know, if we're going to collect this information, I would like to adjudicate anyone that employs people. I don't think that we should target, or either all, I was going to say whole hog or none, but I'm not sure that belongs to this dais.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dellum, I think that sounds reasonable, and I don't see any reason why we couldn't amend the bill to collect that information on public employees as well, or the employers of those employees.
Vice Chair Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the testimony anyway. My question is, how and who is going to gather the information? And the second question, are we talking about all employers, or how do we target some of the employers hiring, such as a group of people, TANF, or WIC program, or any other program assisted by the state government? How do you know that? I'm just confused, you know. That and how do we pay for this program? Employer has to identify each employee who is getting state assistance, federal assistance, or the state government of the Human Services Department. They are going out, each employer, to gather this information. I'm just confused about this, how it's implemented.
Chair Witt, and I apologize, I'm just getting too familiar just talking to my colleagues. Chair Witt, Vice Chair Lim, it's the Department of Human Services is the agency that will be charged with gathering that information. In terms of all of the specifics about how they might go about that and implementing that, I can't answer that right now, but that's the charge and that's how it would work in the bill. In terms of any kind of fiscal, I don't know that that's been sort of...
No, but Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Lim, I'm sure you will be hearing from them.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they can answer that question.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Yes, Representative Colby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think this bill has some great potential in really, I guess, identifying some issues that our state faces and surely across the country we face as far as leveling the playing field. That was the most... one of the most important parts of this, I think, that you touched on was how we basically end up subsidizing certain companies to the detriment of others who are really, you know, doing an exemplary job in our communities. And would it be your intention that this information is also available to local governments as well? Because sometimes I see there's sometimes further subsidy that takes place at the local level through enterprise zones or through some other tax breaks or incentives that go out to companies. And I think this information would be extremely important to a local jurisdiction in making a determination of which companies are really participating in the community at a level at which they feel a subsidy might be more appropriate than others. So, I guess that my question to you is, they're reporting this to the legislature, but will this become, you know, available to local jurisdictions as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I think that's a great point, and absolutely, I think it should be a tool that could be used by any level of government. So it definitely would be.
Anyone else? Not seeing anything. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Next, I'd like to call Jeff Anderson, Arthur Towers, and Duke Shepherd, please. And as our witnesses are coming forward, I'd just like to let the audience know that we have a fairly ambitious agenda today with a lot of witnesses. So brevity would be greatly appreciated. If you could shoot for 2 to 3 minutes, that would be just perfect. Thank you very much, and welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Chair Witt, my name, and committee members, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm with United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. We represent about 20,000 members, 18,000 plus in the active, and at any time transitioning about 1,600 more into our membership. I'm here in support of House Bill 3252. And if you would, I'll just read my remarks or my testimony briefly and then comment additionally, and it'll be, I think, a little more brief. The food industry is arguably one of the most competitive industries in the United States, with profit margins as slim as a penny on the dollar. For some time, the industry has experienced tremendous pressures on employee benefits. These downward pressures have placed a competitive burden on responsible employers to reduce cost and ultimately reduce health benefits. House Bill 3252 is a first step in addressing the lack of transparency of large employers who are shifting the health care costs to the state and other employers. Lawmakers should have all the tools in the toolbox when developing programs that need meet the needs of Oregonians. House Bill 3252 is a real first start. To show you an example of the rising cost of health care, I provided a monthly premium chart based on the annual cost adjustment basis in the back of the packet that we're experiencing in our industry. So you can see that in a few short years, the plan that we have has gone from $280 a month that the employer pays for health insurance to $733 a month. This rate is not sustainable, and frankly, this is with many cuts to the plan design, and yet it's still at $733, and yet with our demographics, we have a very young population. If you look at across broader Oregon society for experiencing rates, it would be much higher. USCW is convinced that some large and profitable employers are shifting their medical costs onto employers as well as the taxpayers of the state. I've included a handout of an extensive study provided by Wake Up Walmart on a state-by-state estimate of the taxpayers' dollars being spent on behalf of one large employer. The study estimates that Oregon has spent over $8 million in just 2005 for employees who qualify for state-assisted health care. House Bill 3252 will provide a much-needed information for policymakers to address these issues. UFCW 555 believes that competition in the marketplace should not be subsidized by taxpayers to the disadvantage of responsible employers. Additionally, I would comment that in the retail industry, we are a zero-sum game. If you build another grocery store in the neighborhood, the same amount of customers in that neighborhood are still only going to buy 1 gallon of milk or 2 gallons of milk. So you're displacing. And so where you have policies or companies that come in and they're using the low-end road, you're actually dragging the entire industry down. So the trends that we see, and why I think policymakers should have this information, frankly, is that we're in a pull market, not a push market. We're experiencing that the entire industry is pushing down the direction of that one large employer that I mentioned. And I would ask that you would support 3252 as it's with certain concerns being addressed as well. But thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's next? Okay.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And my perspective on this bill is somewhat different than Mr. Anderson's, because I think that what this bill allows the committee and policymakers to do is take a broader look at the issue of low-wage work in our communities. I think this is a problem that is, you know, silent in our communities. We had some pretty powerful testimony before your committee, I thought, a couple weeks ago when our child care providers came in and talked about the sort of work that they do and the sort of wages that they make. And our union represents, unfortunately, a large number of low-wage workers. Again, not just the child care providers, but the in-home caregivers for the elderly and disabled. Our nursing home workers don't make a lot of money. But also, surprisingly, there's several thousand state workers who earn less than the minimum threshold for food stamps for a family of four. And one of our big issues in contract negotiations this year is to try to raise the wages for those low-wage workers. I think that this bill will really do a good job to expose how widespread low-wage work is in our community and the cost that puts on taxpayers. So, again, we support House Bill 3252, and thank you for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Duke Shepherd, Oregon AFL-CIO. I really just echo what Arthur was saying. And in terms of the testimony offered also by Representative Galizio, we just view this as one set of information that would be very useful. And it will only be useful in terms of filling a gap. There's a lot of other data out there, and matching this with other data sets is going to help consumers and policymakers make a lot of decisions. I can see where this kind of data would be helpful to the huge number of healthcare conversations going on in this building right now, not to mention issues about tax credits or other public investments that might be related. We presume, in my reading of this, that it would include public sector and nonprofit contractors. We hope it would. We believe it should. And finally, we would not see this as punitive. It's just data. It says what it says, and it is what it is. I would expect that you would see plenty of hardworking small business people just struggling to get by. And I know when I go to a locally owned convenience store, those folks aren't making a lot of money. I'm still going there. I'm trying to help them by spending my money so they make more money. But the policy implications for across the economy are what would really be useful. And without this information, we're sort of flying blind, even though it's clear already. We already sort of acknowledge this exists. We know what's going on, so we can either have the full information in front of us, or we can sort of acknowledge it off to the side and not really deal with it. And we would say, give everybody the information, and you can do with it what you will. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this panel's testimony, and I appreciate Mr. Anderson's comments, especially about the idea of a downward spiral. And I think another way of analyzing this issue might be to look at it as a price distortion. When a company doesn't pay adequately or provide benefits, then it rides on the taxpayers and actually reduces its business costs below what they actually are. And the result is that they're able to sell at lower prices than other businesses. And so that becomes, from an economic point of view, that becomes a price distortion. And it would be, I think, would be very useful for the state to know where that's going on and how much it amounts to.
Additional questions or comments? Yes, Vice Chair Lum.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the testimony anyway. Do you know any other state have a similar bill or already done that, something like this magnitude?
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, in my packet it shows that 19 states currently have some form of disclosure of information on health care costs that taxpayers are subsidizing, and that's where we get the figure that in 2005, federally, across the country, one large employer consumed $1.3 billion in taxpayers' funds using that analytical information. But it's in the sum packet here. 19 states have disclosure information currently. More states have it pending before their legislative bodies.
Additional?
Please.
Maybe it could be a question, could be a comment. I'm not sure how many, but according to the current information, we might have 50 to 60,000 people assisted by the state program, and it could be higher considering all those people. But And already basic information they might have in the Department of Human Services, they might be able to check it out, each one of them, and where they are, what they do, what kind of wages they can get. And why do we need this bill, 3252? Already they can do that.
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, it's been my experience for the last 5 years I've tried to get this information. I've had representatives in past sessions request this information, and they're not able to get it. So at the very minimum, if a legislator can't get this information and if it can't be used in public disclosure, you're actually reacting to a blind policy of not having that information as you make budgets for like the Oregon Health Plan. There's this shifting taking place in healthcare costs, and especially to the taxpayer. Right now, that information is available on computers in this state. It's a matter of making it lawfully available to the public for public purposes in terms of the public ideas debate that Representative Galizio talked about. So I really cannot understand how there would be a large fiscal on something that's already maintained in mainframes, and it's a matter of software development and sharing.
One more question.
Please.
To me, it's getting information is very technical, because I'm not sure whether employer, they have to go to each of the members. Are you on the public assistance program? Or if you are, then what program you are in? What State Department of the Human Services, they might send out some people go over there. This sometimes a human dignity issue. Maybe they might not want to expose themselves. They are, you know, under their public assistance still working. And this might have some problems on the human dignity, personal information, and gathering information, very delicate issue.
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that the intent here would be to gather the information as people apply for the assistance with a simple question of where do you work.
If you would, Chair Witt, Representative Lim, I think they're already asking in some venues that information already. We're not asking in this bill that it disclose any individual name. I don't think that would be appropriate. I believe that somebody for human dignity should not be publicly put out there because they're seeking assistance if they need it. I very much support these programs, and I believe that that personal information should not be shared. But the subset of if a large employer is providing employees a W-2 and a 9-9 and an Oregon medical enrollment form, that is a disturbing trend that has policy implications, and that should be able to be known publicly in terms of the substantive number of people that are on that program, not the individual names, not the individual data. I think that that needs to be private.
Thank you. Representative Dolan.
What I'm understanding is if a person were to sign up for subsistence payments, and they are working poor, they list their job and they list their income so that their eligibility can be established and the amount of eligibility. So what we're going to do with the computer is simply ask it to correlate the information in a different fashion. We have this many people on assistance, where do they work? And so the information would fall out not by name, not by initial, not by anything except a list of where they work. So the economic impact would not be great. And we could do this for any agency, any government agency, any employer, and the information is already there.
Chair Witt, Representative Dolan, that's my understanding is that that's already maintained in different agencies of the state, and it's a matter of making it available through legal disclosure. And that's what I think the intent of this bill is just to make it available. Minimally, it should be available to a lawmaker for making policy.
I might give you an example. In the school business, we identify students that need special educational assistance. In order to qualify for the money, we have to report them. We never report the names. We just report the numbers and the handicapping conditions. This would be similar to that. Thank you.
Jeff, I want to compliment you on the extensive documentation that you've submitted to the committee. I haven't had a chance to go through it all, but was wondering if you know off the top of your head here, and maybe it's in your testimony, how much the typical citizen would have to be paying, or what the cost shift is. Let me rephrase this. What is the cost shift, say, from Walmart that you've documented extensively here, not paying health insurance on its employees? What's the amount of that cost shift? Has anybody done that?
If you just look at the cost that Wake Up Walmart assumes is $1.3 billion in 2005,
mm-hmm.
you can actually probably multiply that by two and or three as a factor that the additional costs are spread to other employers in cost shifting. Unless you're in a managed care health organization, you're in an indemnity fee-for-service plan that is experiencing cost shifting. Cost shifting, I've seen studies between 15 and 25% of the premium you're paying, whether you go to a hospital or emergency room, you're paying for services at a high premium to pay for a societal benefit. So 15 to 25% is a figure of cost shifting. This is the first time since post-World War II that we've dramatically seen a large employer base moving away from a employer healthcare system. And indeed, in fact, that one specific employer, Walmart, has 1.3 million Americans, with 43% of them receiving health care paid by the employer in the year 2005, and that's reflected in that study. That trend, being a push market and rather than a pull market, suggests that other employers to compete will start eroding their medical plans, and that's what we're experiencing. Our costs in our medical plans, and I've been a medical trustee for 12 years, is we're seeing that shift take place. And even if we design the plan and reduce benefits, we're still seeing the experience rates going up. And that cost shifting is a significant factor in that.
Additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony. I'd like to call up, please, Representative Kotek.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. I'm very pleased to be here today, and thank you for allowing me to testify on House Bill 3252. This has been a bill that I've been wanting to see for a while, and I just wanted to add another perspective. As an advocate working on public assistance programs, food stamps, employment-related daycare, other things, one of the things that's come to my attention is one of the things we really need to do is engage the private sector, employers, to be more champions for the programs that are helping their employees. And particularly around employment-related daycare, I've spoken to you several times now around childcare. And I think it was back in 1999, there was actually a study done that provided some aggregate information on the types of employers who had employees who were on the daycare assistance program. It was really interesting. It was, you know, the retail industry, different types of industries that had employees. But I really felt at the time it would be a lot more helpful if we actually knew a lot more about those employers to let them know that their employees were benefiting from this. It's not that they're doing something wrong, but it increases the private-public partnership about how these programs are helping their employees. And then, for example, when we're looking at investing more dollars in our child care program like we are this session, how that's going to benefit them, they might want to know that they have X number of employees that could take advantage of this. I think it's a good way to communicate with the business community about why these programs are important. But when I asked about that way back when, about, well, can we get more employer-specific information, I was told we can't do that. And I just don't think it's helpful. I know other states are doing it, and I'm sure you heard that already. So I just encourage you to support this bill. I think it's about greater transparency. It's about accountability. It's about engaging the private sector around some very important programs. So I just want to thank you for hearing the bill. This is going to be very helpful. It might seem minor, but it's really a helpful bill. So thank you.
I want to thank you very much, Representative Kotek. Questions or comments? Again, thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Vic Todd and Rebecca Nance.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rebecca Nance. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Oregon Employment Department, and I have a little bit of a different tack, and I'm going to try to respect your two-minute time frame here. The Employment Department has serious concerns regarding House Bill 3252, and to cut to the chase in an attempt to be brief, we would respectfully request that the bill be amended to remove Section 1, Subsection 6, and that the proponents of the bill seek alternatives for gathering the information needed to make this proposal work. There are two main concerns that we have. The bill as written, we believe, places us out of federal conformity with unemployment insurance law, and what this means is it means $94 million per biennium that we would not receive for administrative funding for the unemployment insurance program in Oregon. It also means that Oregon's employers would lose the current Federal Unemployment Tax Act credit, which would result in Oregon employers paying additional FUTA taxes of about $1 billion per biennium. The Employment Department currently may disclose information to public officials and other government entities, but if and only if those entities agree to hold the information confidential. Redisclosure does not allow for public disclosure of individual or individual employer information. The second concern that we have, we believe the bill could result in a violation of the Federal Privacy Act, which requires that government agencies obtain informed consent from individuals when Social Security numbers are needed to do any sort of matching or sharing information with other government agencies. In order, as the bill is written, in order to provide the Department of Human Services with the information they would require to produce a report, we would need to match the Human Services client Social Security numbers with Employment Department wage records. And unless DHS were to receive informed consent of all of the individuals, this would violate the Federal Privacy Act. There is an Attorney General opinion. It's opinion number 8226, and it mandates informed consent. This was written back in the job training partnership program days in 1993. So due to federal conformity and other concerns, we would respectfully request again that the bill be amended to remove the Employment Department. Other states do indeed produce reports such as this report. They do not, however, use unemployment insurance information to get there. Just to quickly quote from the February 24th, 06 Ohio report on identifying the number of benefit recipients by employers, in the report on the first page under background information, it states that the U.S. Department of Labor has interpreted federal law to require that conforming state laws provide that employer, wage, and claim information collected and maintained for the administration of unemployment compensation program is confidential and not subject to public disclosure. In addition, I have asked the U.S. Department of Labor to review this bill. They have not yet gotten back to me on this bill. However, I do, again, understand that states produce this report without using wage record information from the unemployment insurance database. And I'd be happy to answer questions, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vic Todd. I'm the administrator for the self-sufficiency programs in the Department of Human Services, Children's, Adults, and Families. And I will be brief. In terms of the issues that we see within this bill as it is, we are concerned about client confidentiality, potential issues, as well as issues around small employers and or employers in small communities where inadvertently the client may be identified because there's a small number of employees and so forth. With that, the funding that we would see that we would need for this is not anticipated in the governor's budget. In my testimony, I reference a similar bill, House Bill 3206, which takes a little bit different approach to this in that it calls for more of a study approach to arrive at the same information, and we believe that that would actually be a lower cost approach to this and still provide that information that would be sought out of such a report. House Bill 3252 really would set up an ongoing process, and as a result of that would cost us more in implementation. The department's more than willing to work in a work group to work through any potential confidentiality issues and or other technical issues to move forward with this. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Todd, I appreciate that last offer on your part very much, that you will work with a work group to help figure out how we're going to handle this kind of issue. I wonder if we'd get the same assurance from the Employment Department.
Absolutely, to the extent that we wouldn't be breaking any federal conformity issues or federal law or the Privacy Act. Absolutely.
At this point, we're asking not for the specific information, but about how we can go through the process of obtaining it without running into the requirements of those laws.
Yes, I understand. We're happy to help. We're happy to participate in any work group that you may gather.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Gerard, did you want to say something?
Well, I did. Thank you, Chair. Well, I was going to kind of rescind it, but confidentiality with this bill gives me major concerns. I deal with HIPAA from a medical standpoint, and there's a lot of rights that go with that. With this, it would seem to me like if the employer ended up on one of these lists and they didn't know they ended up on one of these lists, that they would somehow have the right to find out how they ended up on this list. Do you see that as being a potential problem?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, and Representative Gerard, most definitely that would be an issue. Oftentimes the employer may not know that one of their employees is receiving some form of public assistance. And so we would not be able to speak to that.
Vice Chair Ryder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a little bit of the same concern, not that the employer, not the second half, but the first half. And I would think we would want to exempt from this report very small employers where maybe there are only two or three employees and we would know who they were just by the company. But other than that, I don't believe we need to exempt companies just because they might end up on a list and not know how they got there.
Representative Dolan.
My question's been taken care of, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the cost is another issue, and you mentioned another bill might cost less, this one cost more. And instead of saying that, do you give us any idea how much will it cost approximately? I know this is still up in the air, but can you give us some approximate number? How much will it cost?
Chair Whip, members of the committee, Representative Lim, at this point, the way the bill is currently written, we're anticipating a little over $3 million in terms of the cost to set up a process that's ongoing. And that's why, in looking at House Bill 3206, we felt that that would be a less costly approach to achieving that outcome.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Do you have an idea of what we're spending on services for employed persons through your department now?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, no, not off the
it's
top
more
of my
than $3 million,
head.
Isn't it?
Most assuredly.
Yeah. I mean, it's orders of magnitude larger, isn't it?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, I'd just be speculating, but it's a large number. There's over 400,000 people receiving services in Oregon.
And some of them are, and some of them are employed.
And, exactly.
Thank you.
Both of you have mentioned that in one fashion or another that there are other states that derives similar kinds of information and that this might be available here in the state of Oregon at a lesser cost. Could you suggest a pathway for that? And I know if there's a work group, they'll be taking a look at that, but just to kind of give us a peek under the covers of where we might be headed here.
Chair, would I... This again, Rebecca Nance, Employment Department. The closest state to us is the state of Washington. So I think that that would be a natural place to look for some sort of model. And I have that information I can certainly pull together and provide to the committee.
Okay. Certainly appreciate that very much. Other questions or comments for our panel? Thank you both very, very much. Certainly appreciate your testimonies.
Thank you. Chair, do you have any opponents to the bill?
No, I'm not. I'm not. Well, I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Thank you,
Representative Greenlight. Would you like to?
So I rest here when you're
that, that would be just wonderful. like to call up, please, Lisa Trussell. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here to point out a couple of concerns with the bill as it's currently written. Some have been touched upon by the two previous presenters, but one of the things is that there's a program that Oregon has that I think is really a wonderful public-private partnership, and that's the FEOP program, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And during one of your panels, there was indication that while the employer is giving the employees enrollment information for these subsidized programs, well, AOI, as you know, we have a health insurance program that we offer to our members for their employees, and we've worked closely with the folks at FEOP and Rocky King and his folks to do a couple of things, make sure the plans we're offering are qualified for a subsidy, and then we put stuffers into the invoices. Not every month, but a couple of times a year. We put stuffers into the employer's invoice to make them aware of the program. And from our perspective, what it does is if the employer's covering the employee, which is many times with small employers, they'll pay the premium for the small, for the employee only. If the worker may not be inclined to enroll his dependents, thinking he can't or he or she can't afford it, but with the information on the subsidy which the employer provides, the employer doesn't know which of the employees are actually going to go through with applying for it. So the employee would enroll their employee, their dependents in the program just like everybody else did. The only difference would be that certain employees that chose that were qualified for the program would receive a check at their home about the time the premium was being taken out of their paycheck. So my make a long story short, I think that appearance on a published list could deter employers from wanting to make that information available to their employees because there'd be a perception that they're not offering in a suitable wage job. And every employer's got entry-level jobs. And most employers, depending on the size, have jobs that you can work up to. So the point is to try to get people in the door, and then they have the opportunity to bid on the better positions. The second thing is I'd like you to consider also with this is that with the implementation of the Healthy Kids, it's currently at 350% of poverty level. I think it may have gone to 300, but when I looked at it, I thought it was 350. And that so that would be a whole broader range of people that different entities that would be eligible that would appear on the list. The other thing is that some employers have seasonal work. Representative Gerard brought up agriculture, there's food processing and others. And in my prior life, I worked for a food processor in their HR department, and I actually recruited at the welfare offices in the communities where our facilities were to try and bring people in because they could come back every year. It was, you know, they had the opportunity to move up. So I think that although there are probably definitely employees that are getting benefits that the employer may or may not know about, it could have a chilling effect depending particularly on the FIAT program. And that, I think, for selfish reasons, I like to see that work because that brings in a generally healthy population into your health plan, which helps reduce costs because you're typically getting children. So with that, I will conclude my comments and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Questions or comments? Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you very much, Lisa. You know, I believe that I think previous testifier mentioned employer should help employee in any way they can, and that's a good thing to do. But the reality, it might be difficult to cover everyone insurance and
that's
the whole
right.
thing. And we are concerned public employer. That the hiring employee who are subsidized by the state government, health care, whatever. And then at the same time, if they are not employing them, they might be 100% under the government program. So while state government, federal government helping them, and also the employer also helping them to get away from the state program, and so this is just a two-way program, and I'm hoping just could be just comment in the future, employer might be able to take care as they move up, but at the same time benefiting state government and also the employee also at the same time. So we just cannot see just one side.
Right. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kotek a few minutes ago made what I thought was a very interesting remark about the way in which we should view this data. And I think it's important as we think about this. I've been sort of musing about that remark since then. One of the things that we know is that in other places, healthcare premiums are not a responsibility of the employer in a direct way. They're done by other methods. I think it's extremely valuable for us to understand how the current system is actually functioning. That is the system in which most of healthcare costs are covered through the employer's benefits to employees. My suspicion is that we're going to discover that large numbers of employees are getting help from in other places. I don't see this as a punitive kind of thing. I see this as a way of gathering information so that we can do a better job of planning for the distribution of costs for healthcare in the future.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, if I may, I also heard Representative Kotek's comment and also Representative Dallum's about give stars. And I think that there's a couple of things, and one is, not to assume just because the employer has employee receiving assistance that they're some way bad employer. And secondly is looking at the programs and seeing if are we targeting the people we want with FEOP? Are we targeting the people we want with OHP? Because maybe it's the eligibility of the programs if it's troublesome that there's people working. I look at it the opposite way, that these are people that are in a tough spot. They have a job and they have an opportunity to move forward and they still need some assistance. In the old days, if you got a job, you lost your assistance, and so it was kind of difficult to get back on your feet. I don't disagree with what you said, Representative Barnhart. I think it's just how you go about accomplishing it.
Representative Barnhart, I suspect
like that
if we were to set about designing a health care system at the very present, none of us would probably choose to make it an employment-based delivery system. I'd highly doubt that.
I'm, Mr. Chair, I'm absolutely certain you're right about that. If we were starting from scratch, we wouldn't be doing it that way.
Representative Dellum.
You use the acronym FIAT program. Would you give me the terms as opposed to the acronym?
Yes, it's on line 7 of your bill, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. I apologize.
I just one more comment.
Vice Chairman.
As I read this bill, this is a fair bill, but at the same time, as I hear the public testimony, I'm deeply concerned, not the bill the way as it's written with some is, but I want to make sure in the future when this bill implemented, if it's implemented, make sure it doesn't use the targeted industry. It is written in a broad way, but it could be used in a special way to target some of the business. I'm deeply concerned about that. I just want to put the record in it.
Thank you, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you very much,
Lisa. I'd like to call up, please, Chuck Shuckatoff and Mary Beth Healy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chuck Shuckatoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3252 and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Welcome.
This bill is not going to make the sky fall, as some people may have suggested in earlier testimony. The issue of disclosing around the country the number of which employers have the most people getting public health care and some other public services, as you've heard, basically does stem from the campaigns concerned about what's Walmart doing to the economy. A number of states, but it's not just a Walmart bill. For instance, in Arizona, while Walmart was the largest user of Medicaid, in the list of people with 5% of their employees using Medicaid was Kroger, the owner of Fred Meyer. Kroger was also a big one in Ohio. Now, I want to point out a couple things about the bill. First, the bill changes no substantive statutes at the Oregon Department of Human Services. Why? Because the Oregon Department of Human Services could do this study today without any additional appropriation from the department. I will be requesting the department's analysis of their own and contracting out versions of doing this, why they think it would cost money. But the Department of Human Services has a unit in the administration side called Fiscal and Policy Analysis. What that does is it plans, oversees, coordinates budget development and execution, caseload forecasting, and performs policy analysis of budget and operational issues for department leadership, program policy, and field managers, staff, and external policymakers such as yourself. The department doesn't know, for instance, for its hundreds of FTE, all the projects that those hundreds of FTE are going to do over the course of a biennium. They couldn't tell you 6 months ago all the fiscal analysis they were going to do for the bills that are under consideration this legislative session in this biennium. They have an adequate staffing to do some work that they know they're going to do. They're going to have to work on developing the next biennium's budget. They're going to have to do work analyzing how the current budget's being spent. But they have a whole long list of to-do is assigned. Whether it's an agency says a federal law change, we need to change a state rule, what's the impact, how is it going to affect us, to a whole host of things. They could do this. And in fact, the Oregonian a couple years ago made a public record request for all the Medicaid companies most using Medicaid, having employees with Medicaid. And the department did, without any appropriation, and in fact they didn't even track costs, a little sample study for the Oregonian. It was fairly useless. It was, frankly, a waste of department time, however much it was, because it was. That's why you didn't read about it in the paper, because the Oregonian reporter called me up and said, well, that was a waste. I got this spreadsheet which doesn't tell me anything because they did too small a sample. So they could do this. Proof that they could do this is the state of Ohio, because Ohio, unlike most of the other states that you heard about, actually didn't just look at Medicaid. They properly looked at their temporary assistance to needy families program, the welfare program, and food stamps as well. The reason that's important in Oregon is because our Medicaid expansion program, the program for people who are not getting public assistance, the working poor, is very small. It used to be up to around 140,000. It's now under 30,000. So it's small. Food stamps, however, there's a lot of working poor getting that, child care, and some in TANF. So it's important to do. And what did Ohio do? Ohio finally did the study. That's a state with twice as many food stamp households as we have, three times as many TANF households as we have. They did it in about 4 months' time. They didn't go to their legislature because, like Oregon, they have a unit that does fiscal and policy analysis and has a long list of other duties as assigned. And they did it. And Oregon could do it without any additional appropriation. It would be a shame if this bill went to the Ways and Means Committee. The other thing is that what Ohio did was they didn't use the Employment Department. Now, I think there's some legal there's some questions about whether, and probably valid ones to ask, about whether what the Employment Department could or can't do as a matter of federal law, and whether any Oregon law needs to be changed to comply with federal law to be able to assist the Employment Department. And in fact, the Employment Department could clearly do some analyses looking at who's using it by job sector, you know, construction, retail, grocery chains, and the like. But that's irrelevant. So in fact, if you took out the employee, it would be nice to have the Employment Department help because they do have the Social Security numbers and employer matches for everybody. If you took that out of the bill, no little children would die. You'd still get the information because, again, the Department of Human Services can do this study within their budget, just like Ohio did. Now, why is Ohio also interested? What Ohio did also is they looked at they pulled out the 40 companies with the most people getting public assistance. And that's good to get rid of the problem of confidentiality of a small employers and whatnot. They also made some choices where they looked at franchisees like McDonald's. And while if they went to the Employment Department, you'd have everybody who works at someone who works at a Salem McDonald's would probably have a different employer code than someone who works at a Roseburg and McDonald's, right, because they're franchises. But they said, you know, the issue here isn't by franchisee, is McDonald's, is the McDonald's industry, and is the Wendy's industry. So they merged those, and they did that. And I think that should be part of the instructions if in the legislative history. I don't necessarily think you have to write that into the bill. You merge things like that. So that you're getting those, you're dealing with that problem. And you're not looking at the smaller employers. You do it for the bigger ones to see where our economic development is going. It's very appropriate this is in this committee. We're doing call centers in this state. Are call center employees are they big users of any of these public services? Let's look and find out. So this bill gets us out of the dark. Another reason Ohio is a really good example is they have a computer system like our Department of Human Services. Our Department of Human Services, on their application, asks the name of your employer and how much you pay. And in fact, the department does verifications. Caseworkers will look at pay stubs. They have access to the Employment Department's computer to do verifications. The problem is the Department of Human Services system, they've been putting the employer information, which people write on an application, is getting stupidly typed into a field that cannot be searched. So that would be the first thing. Hopefully this bill would get the department to change their inefficient ways and start putting it into change their computer code to put it into a field that could be searched. And then you're still going to have problems because, for instance, Representative Barnhart may say he works at ABC, and the chair may say he works at ABC Inc., and Representative Gerard may say he works at ABC Company. Well, someone has to sort of, at some point, figure out, are they all the same? Right? And if you don't have access to the business identification numbers, maybe they aren't. But when they're doing the verification, they do have access to that. They have access to the verification numbers, and they can at least check addresses, and they can see it's the same parent company and make those codes. So doing it the first time will hopefully also get them to change the way they're coding information. Now they're taking information from clients, and it's not going into a very useful field in their database, so they can't just pull it out. You'd think they would have had an employer code, so at least it would be pulled out. But it can be done. There are ways the computer geeks at the department, just like the computer geeks in Ohio, were able to use to pull out lots of information, but then they had to do a lot of sorting by hand to match up those McDonald's, match up those ABC Inks with ABC companies and the like. So after the first time, it would be a lot cheaper and easier. Hopefully the computers, this could be a study that could come out right by pushing a couple computer buttons versus a lot of person power to make it happen. So I think it's a good bill. It should not have any fiscal impact. I find it amazing the department thinks it's cheaper to contract this out than do it themselves. They have a huge finance and policy analysis unit. It's probably one of the better examples of if the department likes a bill, it has no fiscal. If they don't like a bill, it has a fiscal. When this came up a couple years ago, the Department of Human Services lobbyists wrote the head of the Employment Department saying, the ball is in AFL-CIO's court, and I don't think it is going anywhere. I have told staff to stop extending time on this issue. We, like you, have lots of other things to keep us busy. Well, I think this is to be something that should keep their department busy and get it done right and maybe force the change in improving their inefficient computer system so it's easier in the future for the annual reports. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. I think we'll hold questions until Mary Beth's had her opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security. We're a statewide nonprofit healthcare advocacy organization working to improve access to quality, affordable, and secure healthcare for all Oregonians. I'm here today to support House Bill 3252 as a step toward the greater transparency and the greater understanding that we all need in understanding the healthcare system and the healthcare crisis. And the fact of the matter, Representative Barnhart, Chair Witt, and I think Representative Dallum, you all kind of mentioned this issue around the cost shift, and I wanted to give you a couple of figures around that. The average family premium in this country right now is $11,480 a year. That is more than a worker would earn for the full year at the federal minimum wage, obviously not at the Oregon minimum wage. So that's something that's very important to take into consideration. In addition, that cost shift that Mr. Anderson spoke about and that you asked about, it is the 10 to 15%. It is $1,128 for each of those family premiums. And I really call that the hidden health tax. And I really feel that that it's not just the shift to public resources from the lack of disclosure and the lack, frankly, of the availability of affordable health care, but also that shift to the commercial market. While in the from 2002 to 2006, public sector health care programs, and we know this from the Oregon Health Plan, over 85,000 individuals lost their health insurance coverage through public programs. That number is matched in the private sector as well. And so this is an issue not only of disclosure, transparency, and accountability, which is very important, but it also is an issue of the broader healthcare debate around affordability of healthcare. And the trend really is putting additional stress on our state budget. So in the interest of time, I just want to say a couple of other things. There were some questions about how many other states have done this. Georgia was the first state to undertake such a public disclosure process. Washington State, just to our north, has also done this. And 23 other states have done that. And in Washington State, there was a 12, I want to get the figure right, a $12 million fiscal amount of the amount of money that the state spent on health care for one employer whose employees were accessing public health care services. And so that's something to consider, again, as we think about the cost shift aspect and how do we reduce the cost of health care for all of us. And I just want to say that the health care crisis does affect all of us. Businesses, obviously, Oregon family budgets, and clearly the state budget. And so as we think about the broader reforms that are going on in the state, I want to bring up 2 points. One, that in the co-chair's recommended budget, there's not a lot of investment in health care programs. We want to think about that because for every $1 million that we invest in public health care programs, we reap $3.1 million of business-related activity and create 30 jobs. This is not something we should look at lightly. And I also want us to think about people like Jason Reed of Coos Bay. He used to be on the Oregon Health Plan, got back to work, made just too much to qualify for the Oregon Health Plan standard, and so now he has no health care coverage. He is a diabetic, so he needs constant medication and monitoring of his illness. So it will be important as we think about these pieces that we think about the people that are impacted as well. And knowing that, you know, knowing what employers are being good corporate citizens and ones who are not will be very helpful to us as we figure out the fair system of financing that includes employers, government, and individuals to solve the healthcare crisis. And I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this today.
Thank you very, very much for your testimony. Any questions or comments from the panel? I mean, from the committee for the panel.
Just one question.
Please, Vice Chair Lim.
And thank you very much for testimony. Such as Georgia, after they have done this, so actually what happened? Were there any changes?
Were there any what, Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, were there any...
Any changes.
Oh, any trends. Yeah. Hold on just 1 second. Chuck, you may know.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knows everything, you know. So in 2002, they found who the leading employers were, and that is the last data that I have in terms of Georgia. I do know, having come from the Southeast as well, that one of the larger grocery chains in Florida and had been moving up to Georgia, they had about 200 employees. The first one had 12,000 employees. So I don't know what's happened since then. And Chuck, I don't know, but I can certainly find out.
I would like to know.
Would you all be interested in that? Okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. Just a quick question. Both of you be willing, if there is a need for a work group, to participate in that process?
Mr. Chair, certainly.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3252. Vice Chair Lim reminds me that the session this morning is at 10 a.m. I'm going to very quickly do a work session on House Bill 2472. Before I open that, my apologies for those of you who have been in the audience for House Joint Memorial 12. We'll have to get to that at a future time. Open the work session on House Bill 2472. Ellen, a brief summary, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Members of the committee, House Bill 2472 had its first public hearing in the committee on February 28th. At that time, some of the issues that were discussed were the bill creates a task force on extending the Washington County commuter rail to Salem. At that time, there was some discussion about adding members to the task force, and you'll see under the committee amendments, the dash one amendment adds the mayor of Donald and the mayor of Woodburn to the membership of the task force. That's the only amendment.
Thank you very much.
I just have a subsequent.
This one does not have a subsequent at this point, Ellen, I understand.
That's correct. It doesn't have a subsequent referral, but you'll see that there was a fiscal statement that was issued on the bill.
Chair?
Yes. Vice Chair Rowley.
I move that we send House Bill 2472 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rowley, if...
Do we have an amendment?
An amendment.
I withdraw that.
Withdrawn. Representative Greenlick, I understand there's an amendment.
There is an amendment. The bill has been... has been getting a lot of excitement along the potential line, and both Donald and Woodburn have asked to be a part of it because it will go through there, and they've been excited about it, so we've developed the Dash 1 amendments that will add the mayor of Donald and the mayor of Woodburn or their designee to the task force.
Thank you very much. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Barnhart moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2472. Questions or discussion?
Very, very quickly.
Yes.
I would note that something over 130 years ago, there was a contest between Eugene and Springfield as to where the railroad was going to run. Eugene won. Springfield's been angry ever since. I think it's important that we include these mayors in this bill.
they're poor losers, aren't they?
On the motion, is there any objection? I'm not seeing any. The Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Also want to note that we have a conceptual amendment from Mr. Charles. Mr. Charles, it will be a short amount of time before this bill has to go to the floor. If you felt that you were able to get an amendment here in a relatively short amount of time, we would certainly be willing to consider that. If you're interested to move forward with an amendment, please come forward.
Mr. Chair, Director John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. I submitted the suggested language yesterday. What else would I need to do?
What we'd need to do is have this drafted by legislative counsel.
I can't do that myself.
I would help him with that.
You would help him?
Mr. Chair, can I ask what that language is?
Certainly. Do we have copies of this handed out?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Gerard, would you please share your copy if you could locate it there with Representative Greenwich? It's in the bold.
I would assist with that amendment, and if we could get it, I would really like to have an amendment here.
Yes.
I'd like not to move it. You know what that means.
Your preference at this point is to not move the bill.
I would like to have this amendment on it here.
How could we do that?
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'm not sure when we would get down to Ledge Council, and I'm not sure what time they would take, but Friday I could report to you on how long it would take them. And if we could have something in hand Friday, I'd move, and if we can't, but if at all possible, I would like to put that amendment in here.
Okay, Chair,
can I comment?
Representative Greenwood, please.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about multiple stages in this process, and this is going to be a 12 to 15 year process. This bill is about the very early discussions about this, basically to find out whether there's interest in a variety of things. Downstream, there are several, both federal and state requirements for the kind of analysis that's proposed here. And, I mean, I'll really argue if the amendment comes in that this burdens the early stage analysis, which is what's proposed in this task force, beyond what ought to be at that point. It also provides fiscal problems to the development of this, which is really, as I say, a very early task. In order to move for federal dollars and all the kinds of things, you have to do this kind of analysis. It will be a part of the process because it's appropriate to be a part of the process. It just burdens this early stage task force, I think, beyond what's appropriate for its job.
Additional discussion, Representative Holby.
No discussion, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to move House Bill 2472 to the floor, as amended, to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Holby has moved House Bill 2472 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Barry, is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
I have no question that the questions for the move, but if there is going to be a change, any amendment additional, we can change in the Senate.
I was going to suggest that myself.
For the time of the sake. And then I'm willing to support this bill as amended at this time.
Thank you, Representative Lim. Charles, I understand how that there'd be an opportunity, Mr. Charles, on the other side.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. It's your call.
Okay. Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barnard?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
I committed to this bill, Representative, or Chair. I will stay with that, but I want to make it a courtesy vote. I want to know what that amendment would do. So I will give you a courtesy yes and talk to you if anything changes.
Thank you very much.
Representative Gerard?
No.
Representative Holden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lynch.
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. Having received the majority vote, House Bill 2472, as amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass. Thank you very much, committee members. Representative Greenlick, would you like to carry that bill?
I'd be very happy to.
Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to dispense with the summary of our next meeting and get to the floor. We are adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.